we begin the hour by getting on board the telephone line and welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
What's up, Chester?
Well, hey, which Chester am I? Am I Chester Good or Chester Proudfoot?
Chester Proudfoot, because he can deliver a mortal blow, whereas TV Chester can't. And so I like to think of you that way in case it came to it.
Yeah, I could do that for you. You know that. You can count on me. Today we're talking about the Beach Boys, who I often get short shrift, I think, compared to some of the other great bands of the 60s. And yeah, there was the surf music, but there was so much more than that to them. And perhaps no better place to explore that than in talking about the most famous unfinished album of the rock and roll era that eventually did get finished, Smile.
Was there ever really any surf music from the Beach Boys, though? I know people say that, and it could be in the lyrics, but I think of surf music as something that's happening instrumentally and in terms of the compositions. It's almost like a novelty kind of writing. And the Beach Boys, their early singles, I mean, right from the start, you can connect a line between what they were doing then, Pet Sounds, Smile, especially, I think, because Smile was this album that was meant to be this grand representation of America and nature, and it had a Mark Twain quality and a Thoreau quality, but with actual smiling and joyousness and childlike simplicity and wonder and health food and all of that kind of all-American kick. So I think there's actually quite a bit of commonality between the early surf singles and at least the ethos with what became the Smile Project.
And what made it unique, among other things, certainly the influence of our friend Van Dyke Parks, who's been on with us, I don't know, six or seven times through the years. He served primarily as Brian Wilson's lyricist on the project, and certainly, I think, had Brian thinking about bigger things than what he normally wrote about.
Van Dyke Parks was to the Beach Boys as Robert Hunter was to the Grateful Dead, right? And it's interesting that like Jerry Garcia and Hunter partnered up, and Brian Wilson and Van Dyke Parks partnered up, because at the same time that I'm regaling those early surfer singles, you wouldn't expect that you're going to get to this point of Smile, where it's as experimental as music gets. It's as out there as Captain Beefheart or really Zappa, whoever else that you want to name. You wouldn't think that this unit would be capable of that, which isn't a knock on them. It just wasn't what they did. But Brian Wilson, he did something kind of similar to what Paul McCartney was doing. Whereas Paul McCartney didn't fall out from his band and create his own sort of private life the way that Brian Wilson did. But he wasn't hanging around with them as much in terms going by McCartney. He would be at these art openings and sort of like man about town, intellectual gadfly. And Brian Wilson was doing the West Coast American version of that. He was hanging out with different people than his brothers and his bandmates and getting these different experiences and influences and doing what the Jefferson Airplane were later to espouse and that whole feed your head routine. So he was amenable and open to everything, and that's really reflected in certainly the project that was Smile.
And it's a pretty rapid change from let's go surfing now, everybody's learning how, to 4 years later, columnated ruins domino.
Let's go surfing. I mean, it was always more Chuck Berry than it was like this affinity for a subgenre. And so I was listening to, like, I was in a cafe recently and Help Me Rhonda came on. You listen to the harmonies of Help Me Rhonda, and no one makes the connection between the two. There's a lot in common with the harmonies on Smile. Sometimes that's sort of like the secret weapon that the Beach Boys had. They could be doing something really out there that might not seem what you'd be into. And the harmonies, just by dint of being there, are going to save it or make you open to what they're doing. In other words, like a Beach Boys song in this period can only be so bad. It's not actually bad, but it can only be so unpalatable because of what they're doing vocally. And so we get to this album, and in a way, the way it eventually came together, this big box set in 2011 that came out on Halloween that year, there really was a focus to the concept. It was new agey in a way, but it had a lot of that Mark Twain vibe to it. Like, Orson Welles was talking with Peter Bogdanovich, and Welles, like myself, was a huge fan of these novels by Booth Tarkington called Penrod and 17, the two of the funniest books ever written, and Bogdanovich had read them, and he agreed. He said, but how come they don't endure like Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer? And Welles said, because this was this overgrown kind of primordial early republic, and so it stood outside of time in a way. And Thoreau wrote that way himself, but without the humor. And that's what was happening on Smile. And there's actually a lot of humor on this record. Now, it's not like side-splitting guffaws, but there is a whimsy to it that you get in hardly any pop music, let alone Beach Boys pop music.
Yeah, and you find it in songs like, you know, Vegetables and Do You Like Worms. And when you mention those harmonies, too, and sometimes people think of Smile as being a very different sound than other Beach Boys records, and yet I don't know that there are better harmonies in many Beach Boys recordings than what you get on the only song from the album that got much radio airplay, Heroes and Villains.
And Heroes and Villains was one of those would-be masterworks that never caught on as a masterwork. And I think it was deliberate, but the production was somewhat boxy. It was like this, almost like this process sound. It was meant as this sort of riff on movies and westerns of all things, and having heroes and villains. And if you listen to the outtakes when they're trying to get this song right, it's some of the most fascinating outtake material that we have by anybody. The way that riff keeps coming back over and over and over again, and even between songs, it's like it's stalking you. It's trailing you, and it's going to catch up with you, but in a good way. And so I think you were also in this period having disappointments to deal with. And one thing I've learned in life is that people do not handle disappointment well. And if something doesn't go exactly the way they want it to go, they can be cooked, especially if they're used to having things going the way they want them to go. So I think when some of these things weren't hitting as Brian Wilson wanted them to, he was beginning to doubt himself, doubt the project, doubt the album, and he had already checked out in a way before with retreating from the band to come up with a lot of this stuff and hang out with his new writing partner. But I think he was also withdrawing when this wasn't coming to fruition the way he wanted it to.
And there's been some revisionist history, largely from Mike Love, who now says, oh no, I liked that music. I loved everything on Pet Sounds, but it's clear that he wasn't crazy about the sound because it wasn't the formula that had been successful. And that antipathy didn't start with Smile, but it went back to some of what he heard on Pet Sounds, which was often written with other lyricists, people like Tony Asher and others.
I can understand why someone might feel that way about Pet Sounds. It's not a monochromatic mood, but it's a bit of a downer. It's not an uplifter. And something doesn't have to be like an all-out uplifter. But me personally, I like a range. I like the sort of like full panoply of moods. And we get more moods on Smile than I think we do on Pet Sounds. But the Beach Boys, it's like one of the myths about them was there never really was a formula, and that becomes more obvious as we get deeper into the 1960s, because they were mixing it up a lot and in short periods of time the way that the Beatles would or the Dylan would, because you're going to have like the sort of aborted remainder, the salvage job from these sessions come out on Smiley Smile, and that's in what, September of 67,
right?
And then they turn around in December, like a week before Christmas, and give you wild honey. That's a lot different. Wild, I mean, and think about that. I love the idea of like that much product coming out. I'm someone who wants to have six books come out a year. So you're doing two albums inside of 3 months, and everything is kind of bunched up with Pet Sounds and Smile and Good Vibrations, which is like part of this project. In the same way that, oh, Strawberry Fields Forever is part of the Sgt. Pepper project. Like, it's in that grouping, even though it doesn't turn up on that album. But it could have. And so people overlooked that because Good Vibrations was the success that Heroes and Villains wasn't. And they used the same kind of approach to cutting up sound, pre-existing sound, and assembling the music that way, which is also what Miles Davis would do on In a Silent Way. I mean, these were radical innovators, especially with Brian Wilson spearheading everything, but it was always couched in that melody, and it wasn't like trying to accept, I don't know, Ornette Coleman's Free Jazz. So when Mike Love has an issue with it, it still has a lot of the Beach Boy hallmarks. Like, if you love the early stuff, you wouldn't listen to Smile and be like, oh, no, it's like a totally different band. You'd be like, oh, no, this is different, but it's clearly by the same people at a different part of their journey, their career, whatever you want to call it.
And as you said, too, there are so many different sounds within this album, from, you know, fun, upbeat songs to one of the best love songs the Beach Boys ever did, and Wonderful, to Surf's Up, which might be the most introspective song other than In My Room.
Right. And In My Room was, I think that was one of those songs that someone like John Lennon would have heard. And that would have surprised him that you could write something that introspective, even if you were a pop star. And Surf's Up is the Beach Boys. It's their, whatever you want to call it, a day in the life. And it's thematically, and even like plot-wise, it has a lot in common with the Who's Tommy, like the entire thing, but it's boiled down because that's what Brian Wilson could do. He could take these big ideas, these big concepts, and he could make them these capsules, is how he would describe them when he talked about like writing a symphony, a teen symphony for God. So Surf's Up is this highly metaphysical affair that begins with nods to Maupassant and Edgar Allan Poe, and if you had just sort of like done the jump in time. Sometimes I imagine like doing the jump in time. Like if you'd done the jump in time, say, from 2009 to 2022, and you looked on Twitter that day and you saw that Tom Brady was picked as the best player in the NFL among his peers, you'd be like, wait, what? How is that possible? Have all the rules of the world changed? You could kind of do that with the Beach Boys, with something like Surf's Up, because there is nothing to suggest that they're going to do anything like that. And so you have like this lost album, but Surf's Up is the lost song. And if you wanted to pick a best Beach Boys song ever, I'm not saying the most emblematic Beach Boys song, Surf's Up would be a real contender for me.
One of the most interesting tracks on the album are The Elements, which also apparently, from what we know, may have tied in to what was going on in poor Brian Wilson's head at the time when they were recording the fire section of The Elements, and he was convinced that they were coming after him, that people were coming for his tapes, and it all went south in a hurry.
It did, but if you listen to the session tapes, they remind me a lot of those Grateful Dead studio recordings, the sessions that we've talked about from 1970, where the Dead had this reputation as being like drugged out slackers and all that stuff. And you listen to them in the studio, Jerry Garcia really cracking the whip. He was driving those guys, and you could tell from just how he talked, the little snippets of advice or the demands he'd make, that he knew music like every which way. He was in command of all of that, well, whatever else he might have been doing in his life. And Brian Wilson's the same way here. He is stopping and starting the musicians throughout. He is giving commands, and he's always correct. it's interesting because you can hear how well he hears what is happening that the other people don't hear.
Mm.
I remember watching David Ortiz during the 2013 World Series, and he'd take a pitch. It's the only example I can think of like this, and you could just see how well he was seeing the ball, hit like 688 in that series or whatever, but how well he was seeing the ball even when he didn't swing. I feel like that's how Brian Wilson was when he was hearing this stuff. He's saying like a little bit faster. And they do it just a little bit faster, and it makes all the difference. And it really like reinforces that idea of this guy's musical brilliance. And I think like in terms of the rock musicians, it was a brilliance that a certain kind of musical brilliance that really he had and Paul McCartney had and no one else, which isn't to say that they were the best, but for this type of know-how, of natural musicality. And then the idea was that he was trying to outdo the Beatles, and they were throwing haymakers and going back and forth. But I don't think it was ever really that way for Brian Wilson. I think that he was progressing and growing in a way, and he wanted to take his bandmates with him. And if he was competing against anything, it was what he last did. But I don't even think he was doing that. I think when you get so in a zone with what you're doing as an artist, that all that matters is what you're working on then and there. And so this was like an awfully big then and there for him. But the way it's been assembled now, and the way that we can listen to it now, it sort of delivers on that mythological promise that was around for so long, so many decades even.
I remember we had the great Hal Blaine on the show a few years back, and he told us about those sessions and how, and not just those, but other Beach Boys sessions, and how odd it was that this young guy would come in to this room full of session players who did hundreds and hundreds of sessions every year, or some of the classical musicians he brought in for the Smile sessions, and they would roll their eyes at first when he would make a suggestion, and then they'd listen to the playback and nod their heads and say, wow, he was right, and he heard that all in his head.
He's a super young guy. I mean, like you said, Brian Wilson's been on this show, and so obviously this is going quite a ways back in time. Gives you an idea of how young he was. I mean, these guys weren't even like 35.
No.
They were much younger than that. I mean, think about the Beatles. When the Beatles broke up, these were guys still in their 20s. I think that's lost on people. So you also would have had the reputation of being a rock and roller or a pop artist or whatever. And the shift is happening around this time, around like 1966, 1967, that you can be a serious musician as someone in the Beach Boys. You had that sort of like silly name. You were a Beatle or whatever. But like there's that shift from 65 to 66. And Brian Wilson is helping that shift come about. But he reminds me as a musician, he reminds me a lot of Mozart. Because Mozart, he had a similar ear to Brian Wilson, where he would write certain parts on certain instruments just because of who was playing them. And the only way you can do that is if you really understand their core sound. And the Beach Boys had these session musicians, but they were so musical themselves. Like it's like the Monkees. The Monkees became pretty musical.
Mm.
Like you just like thought it was these guys who answered this ad. But they were doing their own concept albums like come 1968 and around that time. They weren't just banging around back there. If you could sing like the Beach Boys could sing, do those kind of harmonies, that's not just like we have good voices. There's a depth of musical knowledge that I think is sometimes passed over with the rest of the band members because of what Brian Wilson was. I mean, this is very much a group project. Now, he's leading this group project, but he couldn't have done this group project with any other people than the other Beach Boys.
What's interesting, too, is that after this, almost 40 years of an unfinished opus, finally, Brian, with a lot of help from his great backup band, the guys in the Wonderments, came up with his own version. And I think 2004, Brian Wilson presents Smile. I had a chance to see them do it live, which was absolutely stunning. And then that was really the template that they used to put together the larger Smile sessions in 2011.
You listen to the box set, and you almost sort of wonder, without being glib, it's like, what's the problem here?
Right.
Why couldn't we just put this out? It seems like it works really well. Like, it wasn't that tricky after all. And if people don't know, the way the box set is, there are different versions of it. But if you get, like, the whole shebang or listen to the whole shebang, you get, like, sort of a representative version, a stab at the album, which works as an album. But then you get all of these different outtakes and session tapes. And the session tapes, like, the two biggest ones are built around, it's just them doing heroes and villains and trying to get these parts right over and over and over again, and also good vibrations. And so you can listen to those the way someone might listen to the composition tape and all of the different outtakes for the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever. I find that fascinating because you get the music on display in almost like this accompanying narrative, like a spoken word part of what the intentions are. So, like, if you really like how sounds are put together and achieved and songs are written and the collaborative process, and also just you sticking to your vision and telling people what to do, because that's a big thing that you mentioned. When you come in and you say, this is what I want, other people are going to think, that's not going to work, or I know best. Such is life. And if you're the person who knows and believes you know, you have to impart that knowledge to others, and you can't back down from what you believe in. So Brian Wilson had these demons and these paranoias and all this stuff going on. But when he was there in the studio making this music, he was never backing down. He had this vision that he was true to. And it was a complex vision and a very American vision, a kind of from Plymouth Rock to Hawaii vision. But when you think of, like, the great artistic statements of this country, we have those Twain novels, we have Thoreau's journals, and we have things like the Smile sessions, really.
And Van Dyke Parks often said his inspiration was Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Did the Smile sessions approach or even surpass that level of greatness?
Oh, it's like Rhapsody in Blue, like that's the balloon without air in your hand, and you blow it up with your mouth into, like, something like globular. That's going to be Smile. So yes, I think there's a real conscious connection between works of music like that, like Porgy and Bess. Like, I think of that as a kind of jazzy, the way Miles Davis did, a very jazzy kind of, like, proto Smile. So I think, like, that's the side of the field that we're on. It's in that group, and it can hang with works of art like that. Now, it doesn't have their concision, but what does that mean? I mean, it's in that Moby Dick group. Moby Dick doesn't have the concision, and so much is going into Moby Dick. And I like that kind of thing. I like that sort of, like, leave it all on the ice approach to art making.
And Brian Wilson's 80 now. He's still out there touring, and I know, you know, there are some people that say, well, Brian, the voice isn't what it used to be. Well, whose is at 80? You know, there are only a few Tony Bennetts out there, only one Tony Bennett, and a few that can come close to that. But I love the fact, whether it's Brian Wilson or McCartney or any others, I love the fact that you can see these brilliant artists who are so much more than just singers, and they're still out there performing and doing their craft for us to see. Keep it going as long as you can.
Oh, I agree. Although I wouldn't go. If you gave me a free ticket to go see Paul McCartney, I have no need to experience that now. I feel like oftentimes for people it's a night out, they've got a babysitter, and no matter what happens up on the stage, they're going to be happy. It's kind of like wine-drunk karaoke for them. And so I sometimes see someone come back from, like, a show by The Who. It's not really The Who, right? It's these two guys. And they've never been better. And someone sort of, like, provides musical analysis that you can back up by listening to whatever on YouTube. And that person just gets attacked because a lot of times people want this nostalgia kind of thing. But the idea of being a certain age and still doing what you want to do because you're able to, and it's an outlet for you, I always shame my mom, for instance. It's useful for me that way because she's 75. And she'll be like, I'm so tired. I'm just so tired today. I'm like, McCartney's out there for 2.5 hours. He's moving around. They don't bring him out of a chair and he sits down. He's in Milwaukee. He's in Philadelphia. So really, I think you can handle this today. And like you said, Dylan's older than I would go see Dylan. But for the most part, for me, like I saw McCartney in like 93. I saw the Stones in 94. That was enough. I would just listen to like the Stones, the tape of them playing Leeds in 1971. But I definitely salute people out there doing that. And I'd be there if they were still doing it, which to me was like this high creative and effective level. But yeah, I think it's changed sort of like the whole paradigm of age. People like this doing what they're doing, because back in the day, the only people who did this was like some old blues musician who was in a rocking chair
right.
on a porch. And now it's these guys. And it's not just like one of these guys. They're all sort of taking up this baton, the Stones. It's such an athletic show. And the Who and Kiss, the hottest rock and roll band in the land. You love them, Kimball.
Yeah, not so much. Carrie, by the way, Carrie refers to the Who as who's left.
It depresses me when I read people's accounts because they're so happy with what they heard. And I know, like, if you listen to The Who in 1982, they didn't have it then. It was gone. And so that was quite a while ago. And I'm always about standards and really, must we just accept this and say it's great simply because it's what available. And it concerns me that when people can't think or listen critically, because that's not to be a killjoy. I think it takes away from our efficacy as listeners when we're listening to something like this that really pulls out our listening talents and counts on our listening talents for us to get the most from it that we can with this whole smile back in the day, 1966-67 project. But I think it's super cool that those people are out there and setting an example to get off your ass and go for stuff.
There you go. Well, if you haven't listened, find the Smile Sessions and check out an incredible piece of American music. Colin, we thank you as always. We'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.
Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown.